DW Africa Link.
Hello and a very warm welcome to DW's Africa Link program this Wednesday, the 9th of January. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And my name is Jane Anyinge. Thanks so much for joining us. This broadcast is also streaming live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. So please engage with us on the stories that we'll be covering. Coming up, anxiety in Democratic Republic of Congo as they wait for the presidential results to be announced later today.
Everybody is saying that the waiting has been very long. I've seen someone who told me it's like the return of Jesus. We don't know the moment and the hour. We are just waiting.
We will also hear reactions from South Africa after losing the bid to host the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations to Egypt.
It's a bit of a disappointment because I love soccer. I watch it on TV, it's fine. I won't go there, especially in the countries like Egypt where it's not safe.
I feel like both Egypt and South Africa deserve to host it.
In the U.S., standoff over President Trump's proposed border wall continue to worsen.
Stay with us for these stories and more, but first let's hear other news making headlines around the world.
DW News.
I'm Kai Dambach with the DW News. Malta announced that two rescue ships will be allowed to enter port after they were stuck in the Mediterranean Sea since late December. The ships had 49 rescued migrants on board, but were not allowed to land as EU nations determined which nations would be responsible for taking in these people and another 249 migrants already in Malta. Maltese Prime Minister Joseph Muscat made this statement.
Out of the 249 that landed in Malta in the past days, and the 49 migrants on board the NGO vessels, around 220 persons will be relocated in all to other member states or will be returned to their country of origin. We welcome this show of solidarity and understanding that Malta is going beyond what is required of us.
Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir has vowed to stay in power as protests raged in Khartoum. Al-Bashir told his supporters that he would only step down through an election. Al-Bashir has been in power since 1989, and the next elections are scheduled to take place in 2020. The statement came after 3 weeks of anti-government demonstrations that have left up to 40 people dead and dozens detained. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has referred a Saudi teenager to Australia for consideration for refugee resettlement. 18-year-old Rahaf Al-Kunun said her family was trying to force her into marriage. She has been in Thailand since the weekend and used social media to bring her case to world attention. Australia says it will consider the request. This news comes to you from Deutsche Welle, Germany's international public broadcaster. U.S. President Donald Trump called on Americans and Democrats to support a spending bill that would provide $5.7 billion in funding for a wall between the United States and Mexico. The U.S. government has been shut down since December 22 due to a lack of a spending bill, the second longest shutdown in U.S. history.
To every member of Congress, pass a bill that ends this crisis. To every citizen, call Congress and tell them to finally, after all of these decades, secure our border. This is a choice between right and wrong. Justice and injustice. This is about whether we fulfill our sacred duty to the American citizens we serve.
Democrats have accused Trump of holding the U.S. hostage. Iran says it will continue with its aerospace program despite U.S. warnings. The U.S. warned Iran that it should suspend plans for three space rocket launches, saying this violates a U.N. Security Council resolution. But the Iranian foreign minister said there was no such law that prohibited the launches. And a South African court has ruled that the detention of Mozambique's former finance minister Manuel Chang was legal. Chang was arrested in South Africa in December after he was accused of being involved in fraudulent loans worth about $2 billion, which plunged Mozambique into its worst financial crisis since gaining independence in 1975. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Kai Dambach.
This is Africa Link program. My name is Jane Nyinge.
And I'm Zipora Nyambura. A warm welcome to all of you listening to us on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Please engage with us and tell us what you think about these stories from Congo to Egypt and all over Africa. We are eager to hear from you.
Now we begin in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where tension remains high as they await the results of the presidential election. Congolese activist groups are urging people to be ready to massively take to the streets if the Electoral Commission does not publish presidential election results in accordance with what they termed as the truth of the ballot boxes.
And as they await the elections to be announced later today, pre-election polls say businessman Martin Fayulu is leading, but his supporters fear that President Joseph Kabila plans to rig the vote in favor of his hand-picked candidate, Emmanuel Ramazani Shadary. To expound further on this, I talked to our correspondent, Wendy Bashi, who is at the ground and has been following all the happenings there. And I wanted to know, when shall we finally know the winner?
We've been told that the result will be for today, but we don't know exactly when they will give us the result. Yesterday, they were talking about 24 or 48 hours. So we are still waiting for the official announcement of the result.
What has been the reaction from the opposition about all this delay?
So there was many press conferences yesterday led by opposition, and most of them said the same thing. They want the correct results to be published. And they are warning the CENI if they publish other results, they will ask people to go in the streets to ask for the truth. So the population also is waiting for the opposition to speak, but all of them, they are just waiting for the official announcement of the CENI today.
You have been out in the streets. What is the atmosphere out there and what are people saying about it?
Everybody is saying that the waiting has been very long. I've seen someone who told me it's like the return of Jesus. We don't know the moment and the hour. We are just waiting. The mood is actually quite normal. Yesterday there was like people was very afraid because every shop was closed early, etc. But today, even if there is some place where we haven't seen people like other days, the shops are open, people are going in the streets, the taxi are in the streets, and the children was at school. It's normal, but in some places you can just see many trucks of police people, especially around of the city.
What is the Electoral Commission saying about the credibility of the elections? Because the opposition has already raised fears.
For them, the election was quite good. And there was not a problem of fraud or irregularity or something like that. So for them, they did everything correctly. And the result who they will publish today is the correct one, according to them.
Wendy, there are also reports that activists have threatened to take to the streets. What do we know about it?
There was a press conference today led by Lucha, Filimbi, Contre Rebours, HR, and many other movements. And they also ask for the truth of the election. And they say if the result is not what they are waiting for, if the result is not their expectation, maybe they will ask people to go down in the street and ask for the truth of the election. But for the moment, as all of us, they are just waiting for the official announcement.
I was talking to Wendy Bashi, who is right in the ground at the Democratic Republic of Congo. And you have been telling us what you think about it. John Hillary says it's like they want to attract catastrophe. It's now time to release the results of the election. From now till tomorrow or Friday, the results have to come out.
Thanks so much, John, for that comment. Wamatalaba says tallying election results has never been this difficult. So we are keeping tabs on that story and we will update you as the events unfold. Now, the standoff over Donald Trump's proposed border wall has worsened after the U.S. president used a primetime TV address to insist Congress fund the measure.
Speaking from the Oval Office, Trump said illegal immigration at the border was causing what he called a humanitarian crisis and said a wall was the only way to secure the country.
This is just common sense. The border wall would very quickly pay for itself. The cost of illegal drugs exceeds $500 billion a year, vastly more than the $5.7 billion we have requested from Congress. The wall will also be paid for indirectly by the great new trade deal we have made with Mexico.
U.S. President Donald Trump moving on, of course, this time it's about soccer. The decision to award Egypt the rights to host the Africa Cup of Nations continues to elicit mixed reactions from both soccer fans and football stakeholders.
South African football officials said the 16-1 vote in favor of Egypt by the CAF officials in Senegal was political. Cameroon was stripped of hosting rights last year because of poor preparations and its own political problems. Eddie Micah Jr. has more.
Soccer fans in Egypt thronged cafes and clubs discussing the good news. For them, it was a double victory, winning the right to host the Africa Cup and their player, Mo Salah, being awarded Footballer of the Year prize. Business owners and the stakeholders in the tourism sector have also started counting their gains following a sluggish growth in the sector due to political instability. Many, like Mohamed Salem, believe there are better days ahead.
It is important that Egypt will host the Cup of Nations. It will stimulate tourism and the economy. The economy will rebound and it will put Egypt in a better position in football.
CAF said the decision to vote for Egypt was because South African government hadn't indicated any real support for the bid. Regardless of some criticism, most fans believe they deserved the win.
Egypt deserved to host the competition, and God willing, we will take the responsibility and the competition will be interesting. We will not disappoint North African countries or Arabic countries, though South Africa also deserves to host the competition. But I think Egypt is well ahead of South Africa in terms of football. That is what put us forward.
Egypt's hosting of the African Nations Cup came at the right time, to be honest. Soccer at the moment is not going very well with regards to its audience, security, and the general state of affairs. This, I believe, can greatly boost tourism. I mean, it will help bring Egypt out of its current crisis.
In South Africa, many fans were disappointed with the decision.
It's a bit of a disappointment because I love soccer. Anyway, I guess it's one of those things that we have to accept. I watch it on TV, it's fine. I won't go there, especially in the countries like Egypt, where it's not safe. It would be nice if it was here. You know, if you could see the mood what was here in terms of the 2010, it was nice.
I don't have any problem wherever the AFCON is happening, and I feel like both Egypt and South Africa deserve to host it because Cameroon, the situation in the country did not allow them to host the AFCON. But Egypt is also a nice country. Thus far, I have no problems. I don't see anything wrong with Egypt hosting the AFCON.
With the Africa Cup hardly 5 months away, organizers face a daunting task to prepare on time. It will also be the first championship featuring 24 teams, up from 16.
That's Eddie Micah Jr. with that report. Commenting on that story, Luke Oman says there is no difference. Egypt itself is on the fight against terrorism. And he goes on to say there are better countries ready to host it. He said the likes of Ghana, Morocco, Tunisia, Burkina Faso, and so many. So lots of mixed reactions. Thank you for your feedback.
Zippy, let's go back to our top story, and that is the Congolese people waiting eagerly for the presidential results to be announced later today. And some of you are still commenting on our Facebook page. Monju Irineo says Congolese people should remain calm.
And there's someone here who, by the name Alu Afu, who says France, US and Britain know the winner. I wonder how they know the winner.
That's a good one. Ahil Abraham also says that the US knows the winner.
And of course, there's Niamba who says always blame the US and never know the people who are slaughtering their own people. I think that's a lot of mix of reactions. Thank you very much. You can also contribute on our page right here on DW Africa. Debate with us and tell us what you think. This is Africa Link program coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And my name is Jen Nyinge. This broadcast is also streaming live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. And Mamikina Mayungu, thanks so much for joining us live on Facebook. Domingos Chikoko, you are listening from Angola. Thanks so much for listening this program. And we also have Cosma Osman being a fan, and you're listening from northeastern Nigeria. So please continue talking to us on our Facebook page on the stories that we are covering. And also you can share this video so that we can have a great conversation. Coming up in the next 15 minutes, a Ugandan government plans to get rid of motorcycle riders, commonly known as boda bodas, in its capital's CBD.
About a million people in Kampala will be affected. In every 6 hours, there are 1 million people using boda bodas. People will be affected in terms of businesses. So revenue also will fall. Whoever thinks of removing them must think twice.
And in Ghana, a large proportion of residents still don't have electricity, despite exporting it to its neighbors. But before we go there, let's first head to Uganda. And the government plans to ban motorcycle riders, commonly known as boda boda, from operating within the city center in the capital, Kampala.
In a move meant to streamline and improve public transport, the boda bodas will be replaced by buses and tricycles, locally known as tuk-tuk. If implemented, more than 600,000 boda bodas operating in the city will be rendered jobless. DW's Frank Higa is following this development for us and now reports from Kampala.
At Tukole Boda Boda Garage in Makindye, a Kampala suburb, I meet 26-year-old Chris Chibuka, who has brought his motorcycle for repair. I asked him what would happen to his transport business if the government kicked them out of the city.
When they chase me from the city, even those who benefit from me will lose. The transport system will also be paralyzed.
I walked to the offices of Kampala Capital City Authority to speak to Peter Kauju, the communications manager, about their plan to rid the city of motorcycle transport business. He tells me despite employing many young people, there is need for an organized environment.
They are quicker, but also very dangerous. Our plan is to have buses in the city center, get the commuters, commonly known as taxis, to the periphery of the city, and then also the boda bodas out of the city. It's not about just jobs, it's about safety, aligning people to work in an environment which puts everybody's life at a reduced risk.
Henry Baguma, a local journalist, doesn't agree with the government's plan. He says many, especially the young people, will be rendered jobless, and also the country will be affected economically.
About a million people in Kampala will be affected. In every 6 hours, there are 1 million people using boda bodas. People will be affected in terms of businesses. So revenue also will fall. Just remove them for 6 hours. You tell me what would happen. Whoever thinks of removing them must think twice.
Tina Kwesi, a Kampala city trader, is happy there is a plan to decongest the city. She tells me boda boda riders should not worry about losing jobs, but rather think of tapping into other sectors like agriculture.
That should not be a very big deal. They should go back and venture into other kinds of fields, like agriculture. They can do livestock, so there is so much to do out there. Other than them looking at riding boda bodas as the only job they can do, they should go and try out other things.
I met Charles Nyakwebida at the Department of Architecture and Physical Planning at Makerere University. He tells me the process of kicking out motorcycle riders in the Kampala city center should be done systematically with alternative employment created for those affected.
We need to have integrated a comprehensive planning for the city, which caters for better means of transport. But these people who are now relying on boda boda, especially as a source of income, the government needs to think about what they will do. So if we don't get them alternative employment, maybe in other productive sectors like industry, then they will become a problem for many of the city dwellers and even the suburbs where they will be running to.
Uganda is still grappling with youth unemployment estimated at 1.2 million, and analysts say if there is no alternative plan to create jobs for those who will be affected, the government will be opening another can of worms.
Frank Ayiga there reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
And we did ask, what do you think of this decision? And of course, we have a mix of reactions. Mukisa Hebert says, I don't think that will happen because these borders and some stages in town are still owned by those big people in the government. And he goes on to say, we still wait to vote. Hashtag Bobby Wine 2021.
Thanks for that comment. Binai Echo says this has been implemented in several states in Nigeria. There is limited caution riders have, especially with passengers. However, jobs should be on the standby for them. If not, crime rate will increase immediately, except, of course, they work in rural routes.
And of course, someone else who is also skeptical, Emily J, says, to me, that is happening because there is some big dogs fighting each other, and one is winning the president's favor over the other. So a mix of reactions. Thank you very much. You can also contribute right below there and debate. Tell us what you think. Do you also have borders and how is it in your country?
On the spot.
In Ghana, significant progress has been made in expanding electricity access across the country, particularly in rural areas. Recently, a community in Tamale found in northern part of the country organized an event to celebrate the commissioning of electricity in the area. This means the residents will stop traveling for a long distance to charge their phones, among other things.
Despite the progress, about 1.2 million families are still not connected to the national grid. The government wants everybody to have electricity by the year 2020. From Tamale, Maxwell Suk with more.
It is a joyous moment for the people of Tangne, a peasant settlement around Tamale in northern Ghana. The community has finally been connected to the national electricity grid. Adam Fati, a farmer, told me the people here have been longing for this day.
Life was difficult for us, especially in the night. The place was always dark, but now even if your needle falls at night, you will find it. Our quality of life has improved. We thank our leaders.
In line with Ghana's national energy strategy, every household should have access to electricity by next year. At a function in Tamale, Deputy Minister of Energy, Dr. Mohamed Amin Adam, reiterated the government's commitment.
This will cost us $900 million, but our president is determined to get the money and ensure that every village, every community, everywhere, hamlet, whatever you call it, will have access to electricity as a right, because it is an important ingredient for driving development faster.
The government says it has achieved up to 83% electricity coverage so far across the country. But a U.S.-based energy consortium, Power Africa, says only 50% of people living in rural areas have electricity, with 91% of those in urban areas enjoying the service. Minister Mohamed Amin Adam says the narrative will soon change.
Our president has said to Ghanaians that the remaining 17% that will make all Ghanaians have electricity, he is determined to fulfill that before the end of his first term in office.
Only then can the nightmares of rural dwellers like these women come to an end.
When you want to charge your phone, you have to take it where there is electricity. Sometimes it can take up to 4 days before you get it back. If there's any emergency at that moment, you can't make a call because of the light.
We don't even get cold water to drink because we don't have light. No fridges, not even television. We watch it somewhere else.
The Chinese government is supporting Ghana's rural electrification project in the northern part of the country. Ghana's power supply sources are from hydroelectricity and thermal fuel by crude oil, natural gas and diesel, as well as solar energy. The country exports electricity to Ivory Coast, Togo, Benin, and Burkina Faso, whilst a large proportion of Ghanaians still have no access to electricity.
Maxwell Souk there in Tamale, Ghana. And this story has created a lot of conversation on our Facebook page. So please continue talking to us and we'll read those comments. And Ahmad Museme, hello. Thanks so much for the greetings. You are in Accra. And Roniekitis Semada also says, hello, thanks for the greetings. Please tell us where you are listening this broadcast from.
Living Planet Africa.
Now, after the land reform, many farmers in Zimbabwe weren't sure how to best work their new land. Many still practiced traditional methods such as a slash and burn, which, as we know, has a devastating effect on the environment.
One Zimbabwean with a lot of experience set up a foundation for farming to teach rural farmers how to work according to environmental friendly methods. The result has led to higher yields and better soil protection. DW's Privilege Mushaniru went out to see this pioneering work in process, and his report is now presented by Bruce Amani.
Old habits die hard. Many of Zimbabwe's farmers employ methods that damage the environment, like slash and burn or deep ploughing. Instead of making soil more fertile, they achieve the opposite: lower yields, leached soils, and air pollution. To reduce the negative impact for both farmers and environment, pioneering Brian Aldreeves looked for alternative agricultural methods that could preserve the soil instead.
There's a blanket over the earth here, and you see maize stover from last year, and there's still some wheat stover, at least soybean stover from 2 years ago. And that builds up, and that's a protective blanket, and it allows the water to infiltrate. And so your water table comes up, and then the beetles and worms and ants in the system take that biomass on the surface into the soil, which rehabilitates your whole structure, which you destroy by ploughing.
Aldreeves' organization, Foundations for Farming, was founded after he lost his own farm during Zimbabwe's land reform back in 2000. Instead of giving it to anger, he decided to share his expertise with other farmers. His foundation teaches the basic principles of conservation agriculture and the best ways to optimize yields when using its methods. A concept that also produces a lot of benefits for the farmers, says agronomist Herbert Muzamba.
You are minimizing your production costs in terms of fuel. You are minimizing your compaction of the soil, which normally comes from the plowing, and the tractor itself, it compacts the soil. You are also minimizing the loss of water and some nutrients.
The foundation's work has been tremendously successful. Many small farmers who have employed Brian Aldreeves methods have consistently increased the size of their cereal crop. Like 74-year-old Maggie Chiroza, she farms in a rural community outside Harare. For her, conservation farming has really paid off. Her plot may be small, but her yields are high. She doesn't plow. She only digs small holes for seedlings.
I used to harvest no more than 350-kilogram bags of maize per season in my field. But after the training at the foundation, I harvested 10 bags from a quarter of an acre. That's when I recognized the benefits. It motivated me immensely, and I never looked back.
Training sessions generally last for a fortnight per group. Up to 20 farmers take part. They focus mainly on smart agriculture techniques. The farmers are encouraged to cultivate hardy grains that are drought-resistant, and crop rotation plays a key role. Aldreeves also convinces farmers to use organic fertilizer made out of natural materials like crop residues. A win-win situation for the farmers, the environment and the soil. A living structure you can touch and feel.
That report was compiled by Privilege Mushaniri. And with that, we come to the end of this broadcast. My name is Jane Nyinge.
And I'm Zipporah Nyambura. Bye for now.
DW.
peaceful mind.